listener production.
You have to promise yourself that you're going to get up one more time than you fall down. Because if you don't promise yourself that, just go and get a job. Save yourself the effort.
G'day, I'm Scott Phillips and welcome to The Good Oil. Now, if you're not familiar with the phrase, giving someone the good oil is giving them the good stuff, the important stuff, and the real stuff, which is exactly the aim of our podcast. We bring you conversations with entrepreneurs, executives, and experts, the people who know what's going on, and the people who make things happen. Today's guest is someone who really is making it happen in a very, very attractive sector, at least speaking perfectly, that of whiskey. Mark Coburn, founder of Coburn's Whiskey, welcome to The Good Oil.
Hi, Scott. Great to be here.
Mate, thank you for joining us. Now, I was going to say full disclosure, but for the fun of it, we're doing this one in person, which I think is the very first Good Oil episode I've done in person. And it's because you are a Southern Highlands local like me, about 90-odd minutes out of Sydney. What brings you to the Southern Highlands?
Geographically, where it is, close to the coast, up on the top of an escarpment, the temperature range here, all these things lead into what I do.
Plus, it's God's country, right? Mate, let's get into what you do. I don't imagine too many of our listeners have heard of Coburn's Whiskey, but they're going to in a big way reasonably soon. We'll get to that in a second, but let's go back a step, or maybe half a dozen steps. How does Mark Coburn go about founding his own whiskey distillery?
It's a big dream. It's a very big dream.
I think most people listening are probably going to have that same view, quite honestly. I think it's fine that you may well have the most envy of any guest, I think. I'm sure most of us would at least have some dream at some point of having their own whiskey distillery.
I think you're right. if you tell enough people what you're going to do, you drive yourself to achieving it. Nice. That was my technique, was for about a decade, I would tell everybody that I met that I'm going to build a whiskey distillery one day.
That's awesome. And where did the dream come from?
I walked into a distillery at the back of the Gold Coast, Tambourine Mountain. Right. They made schnapps and I kind of looked at this process and it captures two big things in my life. It creates a nexus. One of them is steam engines, a great love of of building and building steam engines. And the other one is cooking, flavor. And when I looked at a still, I saw a steam engine that created the essence of barley.
Yeah.
And then you put that spirit into a barrel and you extracted the essence of oak. And then you put it into a glass and you put it in front of somebody.
And that's very cool.
You're giving something to somebody that you have created.
Now, I mean, that's awesome. But I ask this question of all the entrepreneurs I speak with because I reckon everybody listening at some point has thought, I should do X. You know, I'm one of those people who goes on holidays and I look at a real estate agent's offices at everywhere I go on holidays think, I could buy a place here, I could leave here, I could move here. And I don't really ever do that. Or I might have an idea for a business and I think, that'd be cool. And then I go back to my day job. There's one thing to go to a whiskey distillery or a schnapps distillery in Tambourine Mountain on the Gold Coast and say, how cool would that be? And I'm sure almost everybody who goes in there has that thought, that dream, that idea, and then goes back to their day job. You are the exception to the rule because you have the same thought, but you're actually the bloke who's then gone and actually done it. Can you kind of, I'm always fascinated by this question, mate, because for me, that's the difference between the dreamer and the doer. You know, and I'm absolutely in the dreamer category. I've got a mate who left working for the Motley Fool where I work and went and did his own thing and said, I just really want to do this thing. And I'm sitting there going, great idea. I kind of like my paycheck and I like my job and it's a great idea, but I'm not going to do it. What takes you from the every man, every woman who says, how cool would that be? And then jumps back on the plane and forgets it. You do that and come home and say, actually, I'm going to go and put whiskey in barrels and try and find a way to sell it and build a business. Why are you different? How are you different? What's the Mark Coburn difference that the rest of us don't have?
I would cut that down to a very simple statement.
Okay.
And that is need of change.
Okay.
Your necessity level to change is really, really low.
Right.
Basically, you're comfortable.
Yes.
And the risk of you changing is quite high. You've got a lot to lose. I'd been self-employed since 1992.
Okay.
I'd had my ups and I had my downs. I'd just had a big down. Mm. I lost everything during the GFC, including my wife's house. That didn't make me very popular domestically. I was in a funk and I had this big need of change moment, and I was all in, and I knew that I needed to be all in. I'm in my late 40s. I knew I only had one big push left in me, one really give it all. Because I knew previously that when you go out and do something and you fail, there was a recovery time. And each time I'd done it, the recovery time had stretched out by a number of more years. First off, I bounced back in 5 years, and then I bounced back in 7 years, and I'm kind of getting to my late 40s, and I'm going, I'll give the... So all in. And when you're all in, it's a very different realm. There's a lot of things that are not off the table for you, that you will go and do, and you will not give up. And that drive, that absolute drive, when I saw the spark of an opportunity, when I was able to get my hands on a little bit of capital and put all my entrepreneurial juice into that capital, that's what happened.
So I want to dive just a little bit deeper into that, because the need of change for some might be, all right, and excuse the vernacular, I'm trying to get a real job. Time to actually go on, get someone to pay me to do a thing where I know I'm going to get paid, the money's coming in, I can pay down my debts, I can pay my rent, I can do those things. Others of us, like you and others, will say, time to go and start another business, do another thing, build another thing, be successful this time around. Again, I think there's something deep, maybe it's DNA, maybe it's culture, maybe it's background, whatever it is. There's something where people have said, I'll try and do this thing, whether it's a business or a project or property or whatever it is, and you say, did it, didn't work, okay, time to get a real job, time to join the workforce and kind of grow up a bit. And again, I'm using those pejoratively. Others will say, you know what, I failed the first time or the second time or the third time, but four is going to be the charm. And there is a real distinction, I think, personality-wise, between those two groups. What is it in you that needs to go and build, to create, to start your own thing, to be your own boss, your own man, maybe that others don't have?
There are two early influences in my life. There is a family friend of my parents, a self-made man, started off as a life insurance salesman. What are they called now? Financial planners. Yes. And he was a very motivated man, and he was in our realm often. And then there was my uncle, who was a very similar man. And my uncle lost several million dollars back in the early 80s, when several million dollars was an extraordinary amount of money. And it broke him, and he never bounced back. And I got to Australia in 89 from New Zealand. I had $1,000 in a backpack. And back then, a one-way airline ticket from New Zealand was $880.
Right.
And within a year, I had saved up a bunch of money, and I was doing okay. And I formed a company.
Okay.
And I called up our family friend Eric and said to Eric, I've got a company. He said, great. Now you're going to learn how to make some money. And he said, but you got to do one thing. If you're going to go down this path, you have to promise yourself that you're going to get up one more time than you fall down.
Right.
Because if you don't promise yourself that, just go and get a job. Save yourself the effort. Because being successful isn't about launching one idea and making $1 million. It's about launching thousands of ideas, gluing them together, resolving all the problems and the issues along the way, no matter what they are, and just doing that all over again every day. And while you're going through the distress of losing everything, you are learning the most invaluable lessons of an entrepreneur. You are fortifying yourself like a castle, because inside those walls, down in those basements, are full of the treasures that you have learned. And without those treasures, without those learnings, without that experience, that anguish, that having to sell assets that you've worked so hard to achieve, you don't have what it takes to be successful yet. Mm. A one-off success is a very fragile thing to be, because you don't know what disaster looks like. You don't know what it smells like. You can't see it coming, and you don't know how to deal with it personally. And this business is by far the hardest thing I've ever been involved in.
It's a remarkable business to launch. This has been a long time coming and still a long time to go, and we'll talk about the future in a bit. Being a serial entrepreneur, was it a case of looking for something and finding whiskey? Did whiskey slap you in the face, say, oh my God, this is the thing? How did you think about the business case relative to the passion? And how do you kind of combine those two components? There are some entrepreneurs who will say, I spoke to one relatively recently who said she looked around and went, which of these things matches the criteria that I need? And settled on a thing that she had some skill in. She understood the economics of it. She said, that's what I'm going to do because it meets the criteria I've set. Others say, I got a passion about this thing. Can I turn it into a business? And there's others that are kind of somewhere in between. Where do you sit on that continuum?
Look, I think the answer to the problem is in the mirror.
Right.
And if you really look at what your assets are and then you play to your strengths, and when you're a solo entrepreneur, as you always are at the beginning, unless you're well healed.
Yes.
You have to have a lot of passion. You've got to get out of bed. You've got to, you know, front up to a staff meeting, which is you. And normally it involves looking at your bank account as part of the staff meeting. Mm. And for me, it was, I'd done things that I wasn't passionate about previously. Mm. And that's great if you're going to build it and sell it, because you're just on a mission to get the hell out of there as soon as you can get enough for it. Whereas for me, I had a much longer plan. I set out on a 100-year business plan. It was a concept that I had come up with, and I can't point to where. I had a fascination with 100-year-old businesses.
Okay.
Delicatessens in New York that own their building.
Yeah.
And when you look at these old businesses, they inevitably own the building.
Yeah.
They're inevitably multi-generational. Mm-hmm. They have this kind of mystique and aura, and their customers love them. People flock from all around the world to attend them. I wanted to build one of those. I wanted to build immortality by building a business that the next generation could either run or sit on the board of. So I had this model in my head. I had to be a certain size to be economic, viable, cost of goods, all of those things. Then I wanted something that I have two daughters, and the whiskey business is fast becoming less of a male domain. The average age of a drinker is late 20s, a whiskey drinker.
Is that right?
Yes, the average age of a whiskey drinker is 27 years old.
Kids are learning.
Yeah, I've got a 33-year-old and a daughter and a 16-year-old daughter.
Okay.
And I just wanted to go out and do this,
yeah.
Do something that was connected to me. I'm waffling now.
No, makes perfect sense, mate. All of that said, if someone had said to me, hey, I'm going to start a whiskey business, I would first have said, cool, can I come? But secondly, I would have said, this is a remarkably difficult business to run. I'm a shareholder in Treasury Wine Estates, a wine business, and it's not the same, but it's not dissimilar. Their biggest issue is finding, firstly, quality ingredients, but then secondly, sitting on the product for an extended period of time to then be able to retail something of value. The capital intensity of a whiskey business or a premium wine business is extraordinary. There are many easier ways to try and turn a buck, maybe not in the long term, but in the short term, the maturation time, and again, you'll tell me what the technical language is, but that the capital required to get to the point of sale is extraordinary. And I probably would have said to someone, are you really sure you want to do this? Because this is, you've chosen a high mountain to climb just to get to not only cash flow neutral, but cash coming in at all. Did that at any point make you think, this is a big bite. Am I sure I want to do this?
You don't overanalyze the darker parts of an idea.
Right.
You just leave them in the dark.
Willfully you, or?
Well, just, you don't, it's my first rodeo.
Right.
So there's a lot of you don't know what you don't know.
Which is how entrepreneurs work. If you knew it all up front, I don't think anyone would start anything.
Correct.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have started this if I knew all of the things that were going to come up along the way. And the list has been stunning. You know, we've had pandemics and wars, interest rate, you know, everything's going on.
Yeah.
The bushfires that raged on the south coast got within 7 kilometres of my place.
Yeah.
2 days later, they went out. But for the year before that, we watched them come towards us. It's hard to imagine the list of things that's come along. Australian wine got kicked out of China.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
You know, an alcohol product removed from the biggest market in the world. Yeah. Who would have thought that would be possible?
Yeah.
Look, I'm not employable. My last job was in 1992.
Right, right.
I don't know why anybody would pay me a wage. So I don't have much choice.
Yeah.
I've had a number of businesses over the years. I've had my successes and my failures, and I just stuck to this idea. I had a few concepts of how this would work. Mm. I'd been in real estate. I'd renovated a lot of properties in the 90s, dozens and dozens and dozens of properties. And then one day a light went off on my head that the only reason people invest in real estate is because banks will lend money against it.
Right.
Well, there's two things in that sentence, an asset mm-hmm. and a lender.
Yeah.
And the penny dropped that a barrel of whiskey, a commodity, is a fairly nondescript item by itself. Mm. It's also at a price point, say $10,000 for a wine barrel size barrel, 225 liter. So you've got an asset that requires time. Well, that sounds awfully like real estate. The bank won't lend against it, so we need other lenders. Well, at $10,000 a hit, there are plenty of lenders in the market. They want an interest rate return. What goes into the barrel isn't what comes out of the barrel. It's a barrel is a fantastic value add. And when I started to put that idea together, I could see that the crowdfunding platforms weren't raising any serious amounts of money for the bulk of their people. The odd one would get $1 million, but most people, 100,000 was a really good turnout. And I needed millions. And I came up with this model of selling a barrel of whiskey on Facebook, and I got laughed out of the room. I got laughed out of lots of rooms. And we went out. I wrote the first ads. I spent 2 years on the phone calling thousands of people, and I sold millions of dollars worth of whiskey. And, you know, that's the whiskey that I'll be releasing next year.
The model, as you rightly point out, mate, is you have investors who are investing in barrels of whiskey, which gives you the working capital to obviously let that time do its thing, right? You effectively, they're paying for you to fill the barrel. Mm-hmm. They want to return at some subsequent point. In theory, when you've been able to make a sale or ready to make a sale, they just have cash come in. That model is perfectly reasonable, except I have to mention the fact that others who've done this haven't exactly covered themselves or your industry in glory. And I'll be honest with you, mate. As an investment advisor myself, I look at the idea of buying a barrel. I'm like, I've seen this movie before and it hasn't exactly worked out. That's got to make your life, frankly, bloody difficult. You know, there's nothing wrong with the model in and of itself, except when it's abused. The same is true of any investment, in any area for any reason. It makes perfect sense to your point. You get paid to fill the barrel effectively, and you get people some money back in a few years' time when the barrel is hopefully closer or ready for sale. It makes a lot of sense up front. With that reputation though, how have you been able to continue to keep the cash register ringing and actually convince or comfort, more importantly, the potential investors that we're not like those other guys?
Gosh. So 6 months after we started, a distillery by the name of Nant in Tasmania went into administration.
Yep.
And we, as an industry, were watching this happen before our eyes. We couldn't stop it. It really made us put some robustness around what we do. So our job was to de-risk it for our barrel owners. And we went down every path we could to de-risk it. One of the things we're very proud of is when the ATO turn up to do an audit of our bond store, which they do unannounced.
All right.
My colleagues tell me that it takes several weeks up to many months for the ATO to finish their audit. Our last audit, they arrived at 10 o'clock in the morning and they were finished by 4 p.m. And that's because all our barrels have an owner. Well, the vast majority of our barrels have an owner. That's not me, that is. And our administration system is as squeaky clean and as transparent and as we just were so over-administered that we save ourselves the grief of a many months long audit.
Yeah.
The last time the ATO turned up, there was the supervisor and the auditor, as there has to be. And the supervisor turned, the auditor turned around to the supervisor and said, maybe when I retire next year, I'll come and work for these guys as a consultant.
Very nice. It's about the highest praise you get from the ATO, I assume.
Look, and it's actually a nice relationship because they know every trick in the book. And what's a little bit quirky is the chairman of my advisory board, a guy by the name of Kim Gillis, was the head of Australian Customs.
Right.
And he wouldn't be on board unless we're squeaky clean. So part of your answer is surround yourself with people who have high integrity, act with high integrity, be transparent, stick to your knitting. So we only have one business. We're all in. We're committed. All our family assets are in this. There's only two shareholders, my wife and I equally. We don't have a mixed up situation going that puts other people's assets at risk because there's a change in direction because shareholders have decided to move in a different direction. Mark Coburn's staying in the direction that he's going, and that's it. And that's why we...
It's an interesting model, mate. There are obviously other listed whiskey and alcohol businesses on the ASX and around the world, and that provides access to capital, but it does change incentives. It does change the way a business is viewed and the influences on that business. How have you, I'll say, resisted the urge? I mean, there is an element of access to capital, which I know you've just talked about. There's potentially a higher valuation for a publicly listed company as opposed to a private one. Certainly a lot of ego stroking if you get to be the CEO and founder of an ASX listed company worth X million dollars. How have you kind of planned through that yourself? How have you avoided the siren song of all of those advantages? Because I'm sure there's more than one investment banker who's pitched you the idea of an ASX listing at some point. How have you kind of resisted that siren song and said, I get it, but it's not for us?
I suppose the first thing is I didn't start this business to get rich. No, I already have more than I need.
Right.
I don't have an extravagant lifestyle to support. And my end goal isn't to die with millions of dollars in the bank.
Right.
I wanted to build something for the next generation. I had an idea of a 100-year business plan. I wanted to be sitting on my porch in my rocking chair when I'm too old to do anything else, enjoying my lifetime's work. And when I die, the bulk of my lifetime's work will be still sitting in barrels aging. And the thought of selling that off for somebody else to capitalize on or affect and damage in any kind of way, or let the accountants go through and turn it into a something that I didn't want it to be. That's what drives me.
Right.
Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it absolutely does. Let's talk about the 100-year-old business plan, because I'm a shareholder of a business called Washington H. Soul Pattinson. I've mentioned it before on the podcast. It's been around since 1896, I think. The fourth generation of the family is still running it. In my head, that's, I don't know what the founders in 1896 had intended for the business. It's a very, very different company now, but still run with that same ethos, the same values, and largely the family are still, you know, the bulk of the shareholders. Again, I know we're talking about a private company versus an ASX listed one, but I think it makes, on one level, you almost have to have that 100-year plan if you're going to, but maybe you don't, there's listed companies, I suppose, as I said, but you are dealing in time. You are dealing in age. You're putting down a barrel now that may not be sold, let alone bottled, for 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years. There is a certain amount of, you can't not, I suppose, at some, if you're genuinely serious about making good whiskey as opposed to just creating a business shell that you can sell to somebody else, you kind of have to have that approach because there is no alternative. You can't, Warren Buffett's got a great quote, which is, I don't know how risque it is these days, but he says, you can't have a baby in a month by getting 9 women pregnant. And the same as the idea of whiskey. You could sell 1 year of whiskey, I suppose, if you chose to, but the reality is you can't speed up time. You've got to trust the process. You've got to put the effort in. You've got to put the product down and then hope that, frankly, in 25 years, the whiskey's any good. I suppose that's one issue. But then two, the fruits of those labors are, by definition, decades hence.
I started with two underlying things that I wanted to achieve as lifetime goals.
Right.
One is to drink my own 25-year-old.
That's awesome.
Right.
That's fantastic.
Yep. 20-year-old.
Right.
By the time I turned 50.
Okay.
And I was 48. So I got whiskey into barrel the 28th of July, 2017, a couple of months after my 50th. And the other one was, I wanted to make the best whiskey in the world.
Nice.
And that is a preposterous statement when you look at how much whiskey there is in the world.
Only one person can do it by definition.
That's right. And I thought if I started with that as my goal and then I lined up everything behind it, and it is a similar idea to a 100-year business plan because you line up everything behind that overarching statement or purpose, and then off we went. That was, I'm going to make the best whiskey in the world. And what's happened since is absolutely beguiling.
I will ask you then to boast, because we were talking before the podcast. You said that despite not having planning to release commercial quantities of Cockburn's whiskey just yet, you have been in a couple of competitions. So I will clear the floor.
All right.
And let you do a little bit of boasting about some competition successes you've had.
Look, my staff staged an intervention on me at a staff meeting a couple of years ago. I was not letting anybody outside the business taste my whiskey because I didn't want bad reviews floating around the whiskey world about Mark Cockburn's whiskey not being up to scratch.
It would kind of torpedo the business plan.
It really would. And I hadn't thought that bit through, trust me. So when they did this little intervention, I remember it very well. They said, but your whiskey's really good. And I said, yeah, but I pay you, so I don't really care what you think, diplomatically.
Yes, yes.
Let's enter a competition. So I chose the Royal Australian Spirit Competition, run by the Adelaide Show, which runs one of the most prestigious wine competitions in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And my staff said, how many entries do you want to put in? Two or three or five? And I said, no, look, 20, for heaven's sake. At least I'll pick up something somewhere.
Right.
And
law of large numbers.
And so we sent out, and I said, you go and choose them, because I didn't even want to be part of my own demise.
Right, right.
And the 20 entries went off. News came back that we got 11 bronzes, and 25 silvers, and 2 golds, and trophy for best cask strength whiskey at the show.
Hey, well done.
So we got 40 out of 40 all up.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That's impressive. Okay.
Yeah, 20 whiskeys into 2 categories each. And we cleaned up. They all won something in both categories.
Wow, well done.
Well, that wasn't good enough, really. There was a bit of trolling that kind of indicated that it was just a provincial Australian show.
Okay.
And we needed to put these trolls to bed. So I went off to the most prestigious and the largest competition in the world, the San Francisco World Spirit Competition.
Mm-hmm.
They've been around for over 20 years. You get 5,500 entries, and they have the best array of judges you could possibly imagine. And once again, we sent 20 in. I sent my brand ambassador and my blender into the warehouse and choose 20. They don't have to be the same. Off they went. And San Francisco called me up and said, you've done well, Mark. You've got two bronzes and a couple of silvers, a couple of golds, and five double golds.
Right. Now, I'm not familiar with double gold. Just is that an extra level of success?
That's a unanimous decision by all of the judges to score you a top points.
Oh, wow.
Which positions you as the best of your type.
That's remarkable.
That's a kind of global reference point to the quality of your whiskey.
That's very impressive. So you're in a position now where you've done all this work. You've got to this point. And yet, I think I'm right in saying you can't buy Cobourne's whiskey anywhere because
you're right.
You simply haven't made it available. And this is what's such a fascinating time to be talking to you because, as I said, not only is the business model terribly capital intensive, it takes a long time to get there. And I imagine you're sleeping a little bit better now after those awards. That must make you feel a little bit better about the potential, not only the reputational value, but simply obviously the quality in and of itself. We all like our own whiskey, I'm sure. I haven't made any, you have. But having other people say this is actually good stuff must give you more confidence. But talk to us about, I guess, the journey to here, but then from here. I feel like we may be at, tipping point's the wrong word, an inflection point probably in the business. You're going to start selling at some point relatively soon. What does that bit look like in your mind?
Look, the awards are a year of us getting ready to go to market.
Right.
I understand what it takes to build a brand.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a luxury brand.
Yeah.
It's not going to be premium. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be ultra premium. It's going to be luxury. And luxury is a particular sector, a particular price point. Mm. If you own something that's very prestigious...
Mm-hmm.
And you worked hard, saved hard, and you put it on your wrist or you slipped it over your shoulders like a nice suit,
mm-hmm.
Or a lady's handbag, and then you turned around and saw it everywhere, you feel like the brand, I've asked a lot of people this question, you feel like the brand has somewhat done the dirty on you. You were sold a ultra premium thing, and then it was turned into a mass market object. We have to avoid the race to the bottom, which is the common success arc of a brand. And scarcity is first and foremost. I'll take that last point back. Scarcity is what keeps your customer a premium customer. The quality of the liquid in the bottle is what gets your customer back, but it's the quality of your brand that gets the customer in the first place. So we're building a brand around very solid ideals and concepts, production techniques, and we're here in the Southern Highlands specifically because I believe this is the best place in Australia to age whiskey.
Right.
770 metres above sea level, 30 k's from the coast. In the afternoons, the sea breeze pushes the clouds off the ocean over Nowra and up the escarpment. They roll down over Robertson. Our temperature drops by 10 to 15 degrees in 45 minutes. And that creates this beautiful environment for aging a barrel of whiskey.
Let me ask you a much more nuts and bolts question.
Yeah.
You are, I won't say fortunate, but it's fortunate you don't have a terrible product on your hand. You've got a great product. You built a great product. You've crafted a great product. How did you learn to make whiskey? Where does a bloke with a range of different business backgrounds say, you know what, I'm going to be the bloke who makes the whiskey? There's one thing about the business model of being a whiskey owner or a whiskey company. Something to say, I'm going to make sure this is great whiskey. That's, I imagine, a long and steep learning curve, or is it not?
You're talking to a guy who left school at 17.
Right.
Did apprenticeship. I'm also the guy that you'd find down at the State Library in the 90s on the weekends with a big fat wad of copy cards. I don't know if you remember the copy cards.
Yeah.
And so I'd be in there pulling books out of stack on how to run a business.
Okay.
And photocopying yards of stuff and taking it home and reading it during the week. And that was my Google back in the day. And I just studied, right. Self-studied.
Right.
I haven't been to university, haven't been to TAFE. Mm. And I have just spent my whole life training my brain to do the next thing I'm interested in. And I go down rabbit holes like a nerd.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I learned to do everything.
And what makes, again, this is a chance for you to boast or to make your promotional claim. There are other people who are in the same boat, who are hoping to make the best whiskey in the world, who are hoping to make the next great Australian whiskey to do what you're doing. And there's a lot of new entrants in this space. How did you give yourself the confidence, expectation, that you could make a great, let alone the best whiskey, a great whiskey? I imagine I could go and read the same books. I would assume my whiskey's not going to be as good as yours because I'm not. I haven't made any. You have, but how do you? I guess it's the entrepreneurial confidence again. But there's one thing to say I want to make whiskey. Another thing to say I think I can do it better than anybody else because I'm going to bring X to the table. What was it for you that gave you the confidence I'm going to be able to make a luxury whiskey that's worthy of the name, the brand, the price?
With all due respect to my fellow whiskey makers, and seriously, I have a lot of admiration for my industry. They are traditionalists generally.
Okay.
They're using a traditional pot still.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Lark is the doyen of Australian whiskey. He showed us that we could go into a fabricator's and have them weld us up a copper pot still. And then if we made some wash, in his case, bought some wash in from the local brewery, put it through the pot still, put it into a barrel, da 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 da. And that was not my game.
Okay.
I have designed my stills myself. I visited distilleries around America looking at their different production techniques. The still that I've built is unique in Australia. Both my stills are unique. One of them is only one other in the world that I know of. And I set out to do things differently.
Mm.
If I wanted to be an outlier in the industry, I couldn't follow the industry down its path.
Yeah.
And the way we've built our distillery is utterly unique. And I kind of thought that the market would follow everybody else for a period of time. And then over time, I would build a cohort of followers and they would be heading off in such a different direction to everybody else. When I say everybody, all the other distillers mm-hmm. with product, then that I would have a distinctly different product that was more unique. And that's the direction that I'm heading in. Now, we're not talking apples and oranges unique, but we're just talking, to use, say, a grape reference, I have different varieties planted and I see that my variety will find a big fan base in the future and will be hard to copy. And that's one of your barriers of entry. I mean, the other one's obviously time.
Yeah.
And I'll be so far down that path before somebody turns and follows me.
It is the beauty of choosing to keep some of that whiskey without selling it is you're almost build into your model. Now, it needs to be successful, but you build into your model the idea of, I've got the whiskey I didn't sell when others did. And that almost by itself provides you with a quantity and a proposition that others can't match because they simply have chosen to follow a different business model.
Well, look, our first year's production of 8,000 litres, we're holding the vast majority of that back because we know we're going to need anniversary bottles for the next 100 years. And it can only come from one year's worth of whiskey. So once that's gone, it's gone. Now the second year, well, we've managed to double production every year for the first 3 or 4 years. We'll be leaning into that for our first releases.
So for the whiskey aficionados, let me spit that out listening, Mark. Describe... is it A or the Coburn's whiskey? What are they getting? Throw some words at us that our listeners will understand. If I eventually buy a bottle of Coburn's, if I can get my hands on one, what are they tasting? What's the experience of drinking a Coburn's whiskey?
Primarily, they're single barrel releases, numbered bottles. You know, you're getting something that's that's a very limited offering. Mm-hmm. You know that when you come back each time, there'll be a variation on the flavor, so you can go on a journey with that bottle. It's not being commoditized like a Johnny Walker. We specialize in large format barrels, which is a point of difference in the industry, less so now, but very much so when I started. Mm. Large format barrels take a lot longer to age, to get the flavor development.
Ah, of course.
Time is crucial. You can't cheat time. There's plenty of polishing techniques in the whiskey game nowadays that are coming up to kind of imitate a bit of time, but real time has a flavor profile. Using larger format wood or barrels makes a more delicate flavor. Our flavor is quite big. The Australian style, based on our climate, is a big flavor, so lots of vanilla. In our case, lots of Christmas cake, dried fruit, caramel. I was in France a month ago, and we have barrel owners all around the world now, which is, I choke up when I think of that. To be trusted from the other side of the world is a very humbling thing as well. And when my barrel owners in France heard that I was coming over to have a look at the export opportunities in France, right, they arranged a few opportunities for me. And one of them was I got to visit the house of Cuvier, Michel Cuvier, who was a Frenchman that was selling wine into the UK in the 1960s,
right,
saw an opportunity to bring unmatured Scotch spirit into France. He put it into barrels, put those barrels into caves in Burgundy, limestone caves in Burgundy.
Right.
And aged whiskey in limestone caves, specializing in sherry barrels. Cuvier himself passed away 10 years ago. His 22-year employee, Jean Arnoux, hosted me. It's a trade-only place. It's a no-cellar door. And because I'd won awards, I got in the door.
Right, nice.
And I happened to be there during the World Cup, and and he was off to see France play that night, and I'm an All Black supporter by nationality. Yes. And I was having a very good World Cup at that point.
You were.
And after walking through these limestone caves and seeing barrels that have been there since the late 70s and 80s, you know, we're talking about whiskey at a level that's just so rarefied.
That's incredible, yeah.
I'm in Jean and his office. I pull out a sample bottle of my whiskey, or two of them. And I've never had my whiskey tasted in such a technical way.
Oh, okay.
And I was really blown away by the praise that it was given, and also how he could see my product fitting into the French market.
Oh, okay.
He was very enthusiastic, very, very enthusiastic. And I realized then that I was a particularly lucky man. My cards had fallen in my favor one step after another. And here I am sitting in one of the greatest whiskey makers, bespoke whiskey makers in the world. He then put me in contact with his Australian distributor as a recommendation. He wants to find me a really good home in France to distribute Cockburns. He gets what I'm about as I get what he's about. It's a very... Yeah.
Very, very cool. Mate, as we get to the end of the podcast, it probably behoves me to ask, when can we get our hands on some Cockburns whiskey? What is the release schedule? What's the plan from here? What's the 2, 3, 5, 7, 10-year plan? I know you're a 100-year business plan kind of guy, but when do we start to see some available on shelves or maybe virtually available online?
On the 28th of July next year, first barrels are 7 years old.
Right.
That means our second year's barrels are 6 years old. The whiskey in them is ready to bottle. We're getting our export market ready. It's going to be a very limited thing. You won't find us on the shelves at Dan Murphy's. You'll probably find us in a specialist whiskey bar in capital cities and a specialist bottle shop in capital cities. If you're lucky,
right,
because our mailing list database will consume, we expect, the vast majority of our supply.
Wow. Okay.
This is luxury, not ultra premium. Mm-hmm. It's the difference between a Ferrari and a Mercedes.
Yeah.
We're not making something for everybody. We're taking the best Australian whiskey to the world, and that's our plan.
How can people find out more about you and about Coburn's whiskey?
Coburns.com.au, C-O-B-U-R-N-S. You'll find me there.
Very good. I wish you all the best, mate. I'm looking forward to seeing the first release of Coburn's whiskey when it comes time for that. But in the meantime, we'll keep in touch. Mark Coburn, thank you for joining me for The Good Oil.
Thank you, Scott. I really appreciate it.
This podcast is hosted by me, Scott Phillips, produced by Ed Gooden, and imaged by Link Kelly.